The headlines, from trade and transit to environment and media, Iran and Turkmenistan sign a number of deals to revamp bilateral cooperation. The first UK flight carrying asylum seekers to Rwanda is grounded thanks to a last-minute ruling by the European Court of Human Rights. Plus, Russia tells Ukrainian forces holed up at a chemical plant in Severodonetsk. They have until Wednesday morning to lay down their arms. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half-hour, Iran and Turkmenistan have signed over a dozen cooperation documents in different fields to further expand bilateral relations. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi and his Turkmen counterpart Serdar Berdimuhamedov oversaw the signing ceremony in Tehran. After the ceremony, Raisi said Iran and Turkmenistan enjoy vast capacity to boost their ties. He also pointed to Iran's determination to sign long-term strategic agreements with its neighbor. Raisi said the Tehran-Ashgabat cooperation would definitely lead to further regional development. The Iranian president also touched on regional problems and stressed that they should be resolved by regional governments. He underlined that foreign presence will not bring security and stability to the region. The Turkmen president, for his part, called for close cooperation with Tehran in issues such as the Caspian Sea legal regime. He also called for enhancing relations with Iran and international bodies. The head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran has criticized the International Atomic Energy Agency for politicizing Iran's nuclear program under Israel's pressure, despite extensive cooperation from Tehran.
The IAEA has time and again inspected Iranian nuclear sites and found no diversion in the country's nuclear program. I hope the agency is freed from the grip of the Zionist regime and stops politically motivated measures to prevent the reputation and credibility of the IAEA and its director general from being harmed further.
Mohammad Islami was speaking a week after the IAEA Board of Governors adopted a resolution accusing Iran of failing to fully cooperate with the agency. Islami rejected that, saying the allegation had been orchestrated by Israel to impede Iran's nuclear progress. He said Iran provided the agency with clarifications regarding its nuclear activities as part of trust-building measures. The IAEA resolution was submitted by the U.S., the U.K., Germany, and France. Iran's foreign minister said the U.S. pushed for the resolution to gain more concessions in talks over the 2015 deal.
Despite continued indirect messages between Tehran and Washington, as well as progress made in the talks, the U.S. unexpectedly submitted a resolution at the IAEA to put political pressure on the Islamic Republic and to gain more concessions in the indirect negotiations. Although the U.S. had informed Iran that the resolution was empty of content, the U.S. itself prompted Tehran to issue a stern warning to Washington over such measure. Iran put forward a new political package, a new initiative to the negotiating table. The U.S. had welcomed the initiative, but at the same time pushed for the resolution.
Amir Abdullahian said that Iran, in reaction to the U.S. move, increased its nuclear activities at some sites. He added, the U.N. nuclear watchdog has been informed about these activities. The top diplomat underlined, however, that despite the recent resolution, Tehran will continue the talks aimed at reviving the 2015 deal until a good, strong, and lasting accord is reached. Political analyst Sayed Mohsen Abbas joined us earlier to give us his thoughts on the recent anti-Iran stance by the IAEA.
Problematic. I mean, first of all, you know, to call a press conference straight after 27 cameras are removed by Iran, given that Rossi knows and the IAEA knows that that's still not in violation of the JCPOA, Iranians still have 40 cameras operating on their sites. Whatever they were doing in terms of those extra cameras was their goodwill. They weren't part of the JCPOA agreement. So for Rossi to sort of play such a big drama with this press conference tells you straight away what the intentions of the IAEA. They're over dramatizing it based on the instructions they're receiving from Tel Aviv and, of course, Washington. And I think that they've really seriously compromised their position. You know, the Iranians, of course, are openly now saying that this whole report is in fact prepared by Israel, and it's a fake and fabricated affair. And they've taken official exception to the IAEA chief Rafael Grossi's visit to Israel just days before the meeting itself. So, you know, that's yet another very, very curious thing for a neutral body like the IAEA to do, to go and meet a nation which has nuclear weapons, you know, for guarantee. You know, some say well up above 200 to 400, and yet they are not part of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. They're not inspected by the IAEA in any way. And they, oh yes, they happen to be the main objector to Iran's peaceful nuclear development.
Russia calls Turkey's possible military operation in Syria unwise, warning that such a move could escalate and destabilize the situation further. Russia's envoy to Syria made the remarks as the Kazakh capital is holding a new round of talks in the Astana format aimed at ending the Syria conflict. Alexander Lavrentiev also described relentless Israeli airstrikes. Israeli strikes, that is, on Syrian territories is unacceptable, saying the issue needs to be focused on the guarantor states of the Astana process for a settlement in Syria. Namely, Iran, Russia, and Turkey are in attendance in Nur-Sultan. There are also the representatives of the Syrian government and opposition, as well as the UN. Ankara says it plans to launch a military operation to establish a so-called safe zone in northern Syria. Damascus has strongly condemned the plan, saying it's part of Ankara's efforts to push for a demographic change in the area. U.S. Advisor for Energy Security Amos Hochstein has met Lebanese officials in Beirut. The Lebanese officials said their country has the right to defend its natural resources in a maritime dispute with Israel. Myram Saleh has more from Beirut.
Senior U.S. Advisor for Energy Security Amos Hochstein met high-ranking Lebanese officials in Beirut. During the talks, Lebanese officials said conditions for talks are confidential, but stressed their main demand is Lebanon maintain its right to defend its natural resources.
For the Lebanese government, the point 29 will be considered as a negotiation point, and the 23 point will be considered as the realistic point that will draw the Lebanese borders over the sea.
The conflict over petrol and gas fields began more than 10 years ago when the U.S. proposed the so-called Hof Line, which is lower than Line 23, stripping Lebanon of some 860 square kilometers. President Michel Aoun, Prime Minister Mikati, and Speaker Nabih Berri all stressed a unified stance for Lebanon that the country will not concede its right to begin drilling offshore.
Because of the American embargo over on Lebanon, we could not drill for our rights to extract our gas and oil, because we have to be delayed until the Israeli and the Zionist entity to extract their wealth before us. Therefore, the American negotiator is taken aside, and it's very obvious that they are not negotiating for our benefit, but for the benefit of our enemy.
A recent move by Israel to attempt drilling in the Karish field, which falls within Line 29, has led to opposition from Beirut. Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah has also warned the floating petrol company Energean against drilling in that area as long as it is disputed, and also cautioned that Israeli drilling could reach depths closer to potentially gas-rich Lebanese fields. Lebanon's main dilemma now is that time is running out and its natural resources could be looted at any time. Analysts believe the officials need to firstly demand that the U.S. lift its undeclared blockade and allow contracted companies to implement their obligations and drill in purely Lebanese fields. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Britain's first flight to take asylum seekers to Rwanda is cancelled after the European Human Rights Court issued last-minute injunctions to stop the deportation of the handful of migrants on board. Shortly before the plane was due to leave, the European Court of Human Rights moved to prevent their deportation. The British government now says it won't be deterred and it will prepare for the next flight. The plan to send some migrants to the East African country has been criticized by some rights groups and international bodies. The United Nations refugee chief has called it a catastrophic act. The government has been forced to fight a series of legal challenges in London courts to stop it from going ahead. Britain says the plan will stem the flow of dangerous sea trips to the country. Iran joins the growing crowd of critics of Britain's plan to send asylum seekers to Rwanda. Tehran says the plan is a historic disgrace for London and all those who try to mask their imperialistic record. Iran's foreign ministry said the forced transfer of asylum seekers to third countries is a clear violation of their rights. Said Khatibzadeh said the silence of countries who proclaim to be the defenders of human rights on this issue is also a shame. The ministry said the plan sets a dangerous precedent that threatens to destroy the international regime for the protection of asylum seekers. The Iranian spokesman said the rights of these asylum seekers, who also include some Iranians, must be observed. 5 years ago, a devastating fire ripped through a London tower block, killing 72 mostly ethnic minority men, women, and children. Despite an ongoing inquiry and numerous government pledges regarding building safety, residents and survivors of Grenfell say another catastrophe is possible unless immediate action is taken. Alina Taylor reports from London.
Survivors, residents of the community, and wider supporters gathered to remember the victims of the Grenfell Inferno 5 years on. Many had gathered in the shadow of the building that still stands as a constant reminder of June 14th, when an inferno engulfed the tower block, leaving scores dead and thousands of others impacted and the nation traumatized. Dignitaries, including politicians and royalty, paid their respects, and for all the acts of heroism during the blaze and in its aftermath, the scars still run deep.
From my perspective, I feel like it's like a Muslim tragedy in London because of the high number of Muslims that were living here, because it was during Ramadan, because of the impact that it's had on the local community. The very first person who was named was a Somalian Muslim out of the list of people who had died in Grenfell. And I think the continuation of our story right now has to be on recognising the impact it had on the community here and what more can we do now.
The reoccurring theme when you speak with people here is the sense of frustration and anger at the way in which survivors, victims, the community, members of their family were all treated and continue to be treated. The pledges that were made, the promises that were broken, and the spectre of another Grenfell being possible.
The official Grenfell inquiry, chaired by Sir Martin Moore-Bick, that so far lasted 4 years and cost £149 million and counting, is attempting to figure out what truly happened and who was responsible. Those still fighting for answers are clear about what justice will mean in this case.
Justice will look like the fact that those people, the leaseholders, people in social housing, you know, in high-rise blocks, are living in habitable, affordable, safe homes. That is what justice will look like on one hand, and on the other hand, as I've said before, justice should look like those who are accountable for, who are responsible for this atrocity, are held accountable.
What I would like to ask this government is, what is it going to take for them to start taking this issue seriously? Is it because the people who died in Grenfell Tower on that night were mostly working class people, were mostly people of colour? Because we know that had Grenfell been in Canary Wharf, that building would not have been covered in illegal flammable cladding. It's utterly outstanding that we're 5 years on, we still have no answers. This community has received no justice. And still, there are residents in this country that are living in buildings covered in the same illegal flammable cladding that was wrapped around Grenfell Tower.
Ahead of any official findings, the community of Grenfell march. They remember, and they will continue the fight for answers and justice. Amina Taylor, London.
Russia says it will open a humanitarian corridor to allow civilians encircled in a chemical plant in the eastern city of Severodonetsk to leave the area. The Russian Defense Ministry said the civilians will be evacuated to the Luhansk region, which is controlled by pro-Russia forces. The Russian military has called on Ukrainian troops in Severodonetsk to lay down arms and stop their, quote, senseless resistance by early Wednesday. Local Ukrainian officials say some 500 people have been seeking shelter in the chemical plant and are under heavy fire. The developments came after Russia destroyed all three bridges which connect Severodonetsk to the nearby city of Lysychansk. Russian forces are currently controlling 70% to 80% of Severodonetsk. The fall of the city could pave the way for Moscow to fully control the mainly Russian-speaking Donbass region. Johnny Miller is in Donetsk. He joined us earlier with the latest on the situation in Severodonetsk, the city where the fiercest clashes are taking place between Russian and Ukrainian forces.
It looks like the battle for Severodonetsk is coming to an end, but it might be in the news for at least the next few days or another week or so. Why? Because there are still civilians there and fighters from the Ukrainian army in this steel plant. It seems like a replay of what happened in Mariupol. It may well be a ploy by the Ukrainians to try and hold up the Russian advance. The Russian army said they're going to spend all day today opening up these civilian corridors. The civilians are only going to come to the Russian side. The Russians may well be worried there might be soldiers trying to hide amongst the civilians, so they're taking them to the Russian side. But it may well be that the Ukrainians are trying to hold up the Russian advance, and it may well be successful if they do that. But it looks like Russia has taken Severodonetsk, which means they've taken pretty much all of the Luhansk region. But this battle for Donbass is still going to go on for many more weeks. Just outside Donetsk here, there's still a huge part of the Ukrainian army. They shelled Donetsk, a massive incoming barrage day before yesterday. So, and that, particularly the fortification of Adievka is a major fortification not far from Donetsk. The Russians are still going to have to take major fortifications in Donbass before they can take the whole of the region.
Clashes have erupted between police and protesters in Ecuador after the leader of an indigenous movement was arrested. The powerful Confederation of Indigenous Nationalities of Ecuador says several people were injured after police fired tear gas at demonstrators. Police say a group of officers was attacked and is being held captive. Anger flared up hours after Leonidas Iza was detained after nationwide protests against rising fuel prices and living costs. He's accused of paralyzing public transport during an anti-government protest. The detention, however, prompted his movement to call for a popular uprising. Now an Ecuadorian judge has ordered his immediate release. The oil-producing South American country has been hit by protests since Monday that saw demonstrators setting up roadblocks in protest at the government's economic policies. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
What is happening in Palestine is not removed from what is happening in the US. There is increased gun violence. The consequences of the gun lobby and weapons manufacturers in the US have destructive and deeply unjust consequences all over the world, including in the murder of Shirin Abu Aghaleh. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Yosra Bitar, writer. This article is published under the heading, Big Players in Finance Profited from Gun used to kill Shirin Abu Aghila. Stay tuned for the first part of this article, please. On May 11, 2022, Al Jazeera journalist Shirin Abu Aghila was killed. It is widely believed that she was intentionally targeted by the Zionist regime armed forces. A CNN investigation concluded that video evidence and witness testimony suggest that Abu Aghila was shot dead in a targeted attack by Israeli forces while doing her job and wearing a clearly marked press vest and helmet. Last week, the Palestinian Attorney General concluded in a new report that the bullet that killed Abu Aghila was a 5.56mm round fired from a Roger Mini 14 semi-automatic rifle. The Connecticut-based company Sturm, Roger & Company Incorporation produces this Roger Mini. Roger was originally founded in 1949 to manufacture firearms for the commercial sporting market. Today, it is one of the largest publicly traded gun companies in the U.S. A network of investors, banks, and directors are the real power behind Roger, providing the company financing and governing as it profits from harm like that committed against Shirin. These profiteers behind Roger include major corporate actors like BlackRock and Vanguard, as well as board members tied to a host of harmful industries and causes. According to Roger's most recent proxy statement, two single asset managers, BlackRock and Vanguard, own more than a quarter of the company. BlackRock, the world's number one asset manager, owns the largest chunk with 15.9% or 2,792,671 shares, an unusually large stake even for BlackRock to have in a company. BlackRock and its CEO Larry Fink have made gestures in recent years around the social responsibility of investors. Fink's 2018 letter to CEOs, for example, stated that society is demanding that company, both public and private, serve a social purpose, and that to prosper over time, every company must not only deliver financial performance, but also show how it makes a positive contribution to society. Nevertheless, BlackRock remains the largest shareholder of the top three publicly traded gun companies. BlackRock seems to know this is a problem. Indeed, it has made statements distancing itself from the gun industry's harm. For example, a BlackRock spokesman recently said, as paraphrased by the New York Times, that BlackRock's holdings of Roger did not mean the company had taken an active investment position on guns. But these statements and positions are an invasion on BlackRock's part. As Roger's top shareholder, BlackRock is in a stronger position than anyone else to hold the company to account. However, it describes the nature of its involvement. The truth is that it has a major stake in Roger that it benefits from and is one of the few actors with the power to do something. The same goes with Vanguard, Sturm's Roger's second largest owner. Vanguard Group, the world's second largest asset manager, owns 10.7% of the company. That is about 1,888,300 shares. Vanguard has also come under heavy scrutiny for its investments in harmful industries. As we reported earlier this year with Action Center on Race and the Economy, Vanguard oversees nearly $6 billion in investments in high-risk sectors in the studied funds that perpetuate environmental and racial injustices. Renaissance Technologies, Sturm Rogers, third largest owner, is a hedge fund based in New York State. Renaissance owns 5.9% of the company, about 1,030,575 shares, according to Sturm Rogers' 2022 proxy statement. This investment has increased dramatically since 2018, when report said on Renaissance Technologies' 1.2% stake in the company. James Simons, the CEO of Renaissance Technologies, is a major donor to the Democratic Party. According to Open Secret, Simons and his wife, Merlin, gave more than $24.5 million to super PACs supporting Democrats in 2020 federal elections, including $11 million to the Senate Majority PAC, $5 million to the House Majority PAC, $4 million to Priorities USA Action, $3 million to Unite the Country, $1.5 million to Strategic Victory Fund, and $10,000 to Just the Truth PAC. James and Merlin Simons also made maximum donations for a combined $139,400 to New York Governor Katie Hochul, who has made gun control a main campaign issue in her electoral campaign in the wake of the white supremacist attack in Buffalo. It's not just the asset managers and hedge funds that own Roger that prop the company up. Banks do this as well. For example, Regions Bank, the biggest bank in Alabama, provides a $40 million line of credit for Roger. Wells Fargo also bans done business with Roger, issuing the gun company a $40 million line of credit in 2018. A 2018 Bloomberg article called Wells Fargo the go-to bank for gun makers and the NRA, and it stated that the bank had helped two of the biggest U.S. firearm and ammunition companies access $431.1 million in loans and bonds since December 2012. Roger has a board of directors whose members govern the company and personally profit from it. These directors own hundreds of thousands of dollars and even millions in Roger stock. Moreover, some of these directors who benefit from weapon sales are also tied to harmful companies and reactionary causes that contribute to upholding gun violence in the U.S. and oppressive regimes worldwide. Fossil fuel and extractive industries. Ronald Whitaker served as the president and CEO of HYCO, a company that produces technology that eases fracking and fossil fuel extraction. Philip Whitman served as the chief finance officer and senior vice president of the Terex Corporation, a construction equipment giant with focuses that include energy and mining. Whitman and his wife have also donated to the National Right to Life Political Action Committee, the PAC, one of the oldest organizations in the U.S. Whitman took $208,630 in 2021 as a Roger director, and his 27,829 company shares are worth $1,848,958 million as of June 6, 2022. Additionally, Michael O. Pfeiffer held leadership positions in Mueller Industries, which has committed a number of environmental violations, including being one of the companies held responsible for soil contamination in Chicago. White supremacist ideology. Sandra Sandy Foreman helped William Shockley promote white supremacist eugenics theories while at Stanford University, though she has claimed that she does not remember working with him. White supremacist ideas like Shockley's have contributed to a growing far-right threat and escalating violent attacks on black people, immigrants, Muslims, and others. Foreman earned $190,864 from Sturm Roger in 2021 and owns 13,570 shares of the company, which are worth $901,590 as of June 6, 2022. And Private Presence. Although he has a step down, it is worth mentioning Michael Jacoby. While chairman of Rogers' board, he refused to engage in dialogue with shareholders concerned about gun safety in the past. In 2021, Jacoby earned $198,090 from Sturm Roger and took in 6,359 shares of company stock worth $422,491 as of June 6, 2022. He was also on the board of Core Civic for 16 years. Core Civic is the largest private prison company in the U.S., owning and managing private prisons and detention centers across the U.S. Core Civic and the private prison industry have come under widespread scrutiny, with many banks fleeing from them to avoid the bad publicity of the association. Numerous scandals, from mishandling COVID-19 outbreaks to forcing detainees to work for little pay while being threatened and deprived of basic rights, have occurred in its facilities.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The Northern Ireland Protocol remains a sticking point between the UK and the EU. The British Foreign Secretary claims that London's plan to override some post-Brexit trade rules does not break international law, and there is no reason for the EU to take legal action over the UK's plans to change parts of the agreement. And that after the bloc threatened against London's unilateral revision of Northern Ireland's post-Brexit trade arrangements. Britain has introduced legislation that would remove customs checks on some goods entering Northern Ireland from the rest of the UK. The EU calls this a violation of the deal. The EU Commission is considering reopening a suspended infringement procedure against Britain. Welcome to The Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi, and these are our guests in this episode of the program. Journalist and commentator James Tweedy joining us out of Plymouth. Also with us will be journalist, author, and activist Fra Hughes out of Belfast.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Good to have both of you on the show, gentlemen. Now, starting with James, the EU's threatening with legal action. As you heard, the U.S. is urging negotiations, Prime Minister Johnson claiming that there is no other way to protect the peace process. Such a mess, isn't it?
Well, it's gotten that way. The question is, you know, on what basis are they going to take legal action? The accusation against Britain is that this would be a breach of international law, but that's that doesn't really stand up, I don't think, because the action that Britain is going to take is essentially to invoke Article 16 of the protocol. So, you know, it's not a breach of the treaty because it's part of the treaty. And that, if you read us, describe that as tearing up the treaty, but it obviously is not. What it means is that you, including the EU, take action, the protocol or the fine, if trade, if it's free trade. But then when you read, what you see is, well, okay, they've got to give the other.
Okay. Unfortunately, we lost that connection. So let me go to Fra Hughes. Fra, the Northern Ireland Protocol is a crucial part of the post-Brexit trade agreement. So what are the chances of a trade war between Britain and the EU now that the legislation overwrites parts of the Brexit deal?
I think it's important that it's quite possible that there could be a trade war not only with the European Union, but also with America. I believe it was Nancy Pelosi stated that if Britain introduced unilateral changes to the agreed Brexit Northern Ireland Protocol, that would endanger any future trade agreements with the United Kingdom, between the United Kingdom and the USA. But I think what we have here is a case of the tail wagging the dog. There's nothing in these changes that are really in the interests of the people of Great Britain, that being Scotland, England and Wales, as the Northern Ireland Protocol does not affect them. What it does affect is a small section of society here who want to remain pro-British. They are the British settler colonial residents from several hundred years ago. These people are the ones who are dictating what is acceptable and what is not acceptable. We have the DUP as the regional kind of political representatives of working class, middle class, loyalists and unionists, refusing to go into the regional assembly at Stormont. And without them, you cannot have a functioning devolved assembly without cross-community bilateral support. We also have threats of violence from loyalist paramilitaries in the background. And indeed, only last week, a man was stopped on the Shankill Road as someone by the name of Winston Irvine, who had two firearms and 200 bullets in the boot of his car. So I think this is more to do with appeasing unionism and loyalism than it has anything to do with upholding the sovereign rights that the UK says is at the forefront of these further needed and required negotiations.
Okay. James, the embattled British Prime Minister is saying that the proposed changes are relatively trivial. The EU firmly opposes the move. It says that the unilateral action is a clear breach of international law. How do you look at this?
Okay, look, the argument that Johnson knew what he was signing up for and you know, was not naive and knew that the Northern Ireland Protocol would mean this is yeah, that's about that holds water. The European Union's on that this is going to somehow undermine, that it's necessary, that the protocol is even necessary, is questionable in itself, because the protocol, let's say, it keeps Northern Ireland in the EU's internal market, and therefore not in the in the British trade jurisdiction, let's say. And the argument for that is that they don't, and it restricts the flow of goods from the UK into Northern Ireland, the rest of the UK into Northern Ireland. And you know, their argument is that Britain, you know, might use if they don't have customs checks on those goods, the UK might be able to smuggle goods into the EU. Well, that's not going to work, is it? That doesn't fly, because most of the trade between that goes between Britain and Ireland, the island of Ireland, as they say, goes to the Republic. It goes through Dublin and other ports, mm-hmm. And comes back the other way, by the way. And very little passes over that land border between the six counties, as they say, and the Republic. What goes over is local traffic. So that's a canard. The EU has, you know, the EU is not innocent here. They've been refusing to negotiate on this. And, you know, that the government's, the British government's accusation on, in that regard is valid. What else can we say? Britain is talking about invoking Article 16 of the treaty. It's in the treaty, you know. What does it mean? Right. Well, it means that either side can make changes if it's disrupting trade or if it's disrupting social cohesion. Now, the British government says, well, yeah, it is, because people are rioting about this. And you may say, well, the people who are rioting are unionists, and the unionists are opposed to the protocol, and, you know, they're creating the conditions, but, you know, it's there. I mean, by the way, when the protocol was being, and the whole withdrawal agreement was being negotiated, Sinn Féin threatened, well, they said, they warned, not threatened particularly, they warned that there would be a return to violence if the hard border imposed between Northern Ireland and the Republic. Uh-huh. That warning sounds a lot like a threat. It's not a very credible threat because a good, you know, the Belfast Peace Agreement was signed back in 1998, and the people who were fighting are, you know, rather old now. But they probably don't want to go back to any kind of violence, most of them. But, you know, also the UK was not the one threatening to impose a hard border. It was the EU that was talking about that. You know, the thing is, it's a mess. Boris Johnson, who directly negotiated this with Ursula von der Leyen, is responsible for signing it.
Right.
But, you know, Boris Johnson is not the only person affected by it. And, you know, he may, you know, it's up to the people of Northern Ireland. There's a lot of talk also about the, you know, the Good Friday Agreement comes into it. You know, the idea that there mustn't be a hard border is supposedly written into the, it's an interpretation of the Good Friday Agreement, but the Good Friday Agreement is not just for the Republican community in Northern Ireland, it's also for the Unionists, because the Unionist paramilitary involved in the conflict. You know, some of the former, you know, parties to get together, because no party has a majority in the Stormont Assembly, and former government. And you know, allow politics to proceed the way it does in you know, every other country.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Boris Johnson has defied all the criticisms going his way and published legislation to, as some people call it, rip up the Brexit, and insist that there is no other way to protect the peace process in Northern Ireland. Is there really no other way?
Well, let's look at that question in its entirety. What is the threat to the Northern Ireland peace process? Mm-hmm. The majority of people here voted to remain within the European Union. The majority of elected representatives of the people at Stormont, the regional Northern Ireland Assembly, are happy with the Northern Ireland Protocol. So the only people threatening the stability of the Good Friday Agreement, the Belfast Agreement, and peace that we have lived with and through for the last 30-odd years, or whatever it happens to be, the only threat to that is from militant unionism and from loyalist paramilitaries. And as soon as people accept that to be the complete and real truth of the situation, and the sooner the British government and others face down the threat of loyalist violence, which is hanging in the background, we are marking a centenary of 100 years of partition on the island of Ireland, brought to us by British guns and by guns of loyalist paramilitaries of the Ulster Volunteer Force of 1912 and people after that. So they are the threat to the peace process. If people want peace and stability, leave the Northern Ireland Protocol alone. It's been agreed with the British government. It's been agreed with 26 other countries within the European Union face down loyalist extremists, and within 15 years, it's quite possible Ireland will be reunified, and this will not be a problem because the whole country will probably be in its entirety out of the United Kingdom and completely within the European Union.
Okay. James, Northern Ireland's unionists have refused to join a power-sharing government in Belfast, with Sinn Féin that you mentioned, unless the protocol that covers trading arrangements in the region is rewritten. Let's have your thoughts on that.
Okay. I mean, like I was saying earlier, power sharing is part of the Good Friday Agreement, but, you know, you may ask what's so good about the Good Friday Agreement in that regard. And, you know, as my fellow guest said, you know, he's arguing that the majority of members of the Stormont Assembly are in favour of the protocol. I'll get into that in a minute. Well, why not allow them to form a majority government then, instead of having this power sharing thing, which is a political fudge? I mean, you only have this in you know, there's no real need for it, let's say. But, I mean, you go a bit further with this. I mean, who really wants the protocol? I mean, Sinn Féin doesn't want the protocol. It wants reunification, and Irish reunification, and that is one solution to the problem. But another solution would be for the Republic of Ireland to leave the EU. It might be easier, in fact, because for reunification you have to have a majority on both sides of the border in favour of it. And Ireland leaving the EU would only require a referendum in the south. Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, trades a lot more with the UK than it does with the EU. So actually, the Republic being outside of the EU would be beneficial for it. And now it's also, since Britain has left and EU tax income has gone down, you know, tax income from the member states to Brussels has gone down, and Ireland is now a net sort of payer in to the EU treasury as well. So this isn't a great situation. And the EU hasn't really been kind to the Republic of Ireland over the years either. So, yeah, okay. Look at some of the other parties. I mean, the DUP doesn't want the protocol. The DUP wants, you know, Northern Ireland to stay part of the UK forever. Other parties, the SDLP, they don't want the protocol. They want Britain back in the EU, don't they? Because they, you know, they probably did quite well off the whole European Parliament gravy train. Really.
Okay.
So that's what they want, you know.
All right.
Nobody really, I don't think they really want the protocol. They have other ulterior motives. And using Brexit or the situation of Brexit as to sort of Irish reunification onto, that's likely to be problematic. You know what I mean? People are not going to be satisfied with that.
Okay, James, Fry doesn't seem to agree with you. Let him now.
By all means, have a border poll, as they say, a referendum on the issue of reunification, but don't link it to Brexit, and don't link it to the EU, because the EU, you know, it's problematic in a lot of ways.
It's Fry's time now.
EU is becoming synonymous with NATO.
Okay, James.
The Republic of Ireland is not a member of NATO.
Okay, Fry's turn. Go ahead, Fry.
Has, you know, been allowing the U.S.
Say about power sharing. As part of the mechanism to bring about a united government at Stormont, they brought in the De Hondt principle. Now, I am an Irish Republican Socialist, and I have lived in a country that has been partitioned by the British for 100 years. The first 50 years, up until 1970, votes were based not from one person, one vote. We had a gerrymandered state that gave a pro-British, pro-Protestant, pro-Unionist majority at the regime. In Stormont, we had a one-party, 10-pot semi-dictatorship for 50 years, which led to the civil rights movement, which led to a demand for equality within the north of Ireland, within its institutions. This led to violence on the streets of Northern Ireland, the north of Ireland, and led to 25 to 30 years of conflict. But the Hunt mechanism is there to prevent unionists rejoining. There are separate strands of unionism represented at the regional assembly. If they join together in some form of a democratic government, what they would do is reinstitute the sectarian discriminations that people of my generation and above suffered for over 50 years. So without power sharing, there will be no devolved assembly. The people of Ireland are very much in favour of the EU. Personally, I am not in favour of the EU. I voted for Brexit. I believe in national sovereignty, but I'm not stupid and I am not naive. I live in this country. I know the politics. I know the sectarian nature. And I know that it is loyalist extremism that is forcing the British government to renegotiate the Northern Ireland Protocol.
Okay, James, sorry for the interruption, but we have only 2-3 minutes for each question. I have to handle this. We've talked about Ireland enough. Let's talk about Scotland. You know, Nicola Sturgeon, James, is talking about holding a second independence vote from Britain by the end of next year. And she's arguing that Scotland will be better off outside of the UK. Is she right?
No, not at all. I mean, she doesn't. The Scottish government, the Scottish devolved administration and the Scottish Parliament, they don't have the power to call the referendum. So what they're talking about would be, you know, it would be like a kind of protest thing, just like they did in Catalonia a few years ago. Except this time, probably, you know, unlike in Catalonia, they probably won't arrest Nicola Sturgeon and the SNP leadership. But Scotland, about 60% of the goods that are produced in Scotland are sold in England, Wales, and Northern Ireland. And about less than a third as much of that is exported to EU member states. So no, it wouldn't. And Sturgeon was forced to admit today that they would have the same problem as with Northern Ireland currently if they left, if they became independent from Britain, they would be in the EU common market and Britain would not, and you'd have to have tariffs and customs checks and so forth at the border, maybe not tariffs if the free trade agreement holds up, but you'd have to have customs checks, so there would be problems with moving goods. And there are people who live on one side of the border, as they say, which is not a border, between Scotland and the historic border between Scotland and England, and work on the other side. And they would be, you know, they would be citizens of different countries and they would have to go through passport control to go to work and back every day. You know what I mean? It's a ridiculous idea. The two countries are economically and socially integrated for hundreds of years.
Okay.
And it is ridiculous to talk about separating them. I mean, just as, you know, there are 1 million Irish people living in the UK and 200,000 UK citizens living in the Republic of Ireland.
Okay, James, if you allow me, we're running out of time. We have only 1 minute and a half for Fra to answer the same questions.
About Scottish independence, I think you're either a Democrat or you're not a Democrat. You either believe that the people of any nation have the right to elect a government to act on their behalf, and if they want independence, that they should have independence. There are 26 countries in the European Union who are all connected in various stages. They all have land borders with each other. I know that through the European Union, those borders are now open, but they have separate languages. They have separate sovereign states. They have separate means of production within all those different countries. I am a Democrat. I believe, like many Scots and many Irish people do, that Scotland and Ireland have been subjugated under British military and political occupation for centuries. If you believe in democracy and the Scottish people want independence, why not let them have a referendum? Why not let them vote for it? And why not say, if you want your freedom and you want your independence and you want your dignity, and you vote for it in a referendum, and the referendum reaches 51% of the population, then as a Scottish or Irish person, I would demand that referendum respect.
Okay, interesting discussion, but we're just running out of time very quickly. So thank you, my guest, James Tudy in Plymouth, and Fra Hughes in Belfast.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wa salam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
Ziyarah of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam.
As-salamu alayka ya Mawlai Musa ibn Ja'far wa rahmatullah.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners. I'm your host, Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. And Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam from among the household of the Holy Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. Now, it is interesting to know that Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam was the testamentary trustee and he was the seventh divinely appointed successor, vice regent, Imam of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam was also the testamentary trustee and the only successor of the sixth divinely appointed Imam,